Hi everyone. We should have a few more people joining us shortly, but we're going to go ahead and get started. Thanks for attending the 2020 Sunstone Digital Symposium session 353, titled Achieving Zion: The Impact of Racism on Becoming One. The audio from this session will be available for purchase at sunstone.org after the symposium. The video recording of this session will be available in the Whova app for the remainder of 2020. So just as a reminder for the Q&A, please type your questions into the Whova app directly to be addressed during the Q&A at the end of the session. And it should be a really good one. Misha is very, very intelligent. So at Sunstone, we're making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our tagline is, "There's more than just one way to Mormon." We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. Please support us in our mission by making a donation and subscribing at sunstone.org. Okay, awesome. So about this presentation, systemic racism is present in all communities, and Mormonism has uniquely benefited from white supremacy. During this session, Dr. Misha McGriggs, a psychologist and racial equity educator, will lead an exploration of the theological, relational, and personal aspects of racism. Zion cannot be achieved unless the sin of racism is rooted out and repented of. Restitution must be made within ourselves and our community. White Mormons all along the spectrum of orthodoxy must reconcile with their history and mythologized racial innocence in order to truly become one with self and community. So, I will take a second now to introduce you to our speaker before we begin. Dr. Misha McGriggs earned a PhD in counseling psychology at, like we said, Brigham Young University, went on to complete a postdoctoral fellowship at Columbia University. Her area of expertise is in the somatic embodiment of racial trauma. Along with her clinical and academic work, she has worked as a consultant on issues of diversity, equity, and the inclusion at the organizational level, excuse me, and inclusion at the organizational level for several years. Dr. McGriggs has contributed widely to the academic and public discourse on the intersections of race, gender, and religion and spirituality. Her work has been featured in media outlets, including NPR, CNN, Teen Vogue, Fusion, CBS News, the Salt Lake Tribune, Huffington Post, Newsweek, and Seattle PI, amongst others. She resides in New York and works at an independent school where she leads work in diversity, equity, and inclusion. Teen Vogue is on fire. Have you noticed that?
They're doing good stuff. They have a
They're
good
like,
editor in chief.
yeah, they're accessible, and the stuff that they're pushing forward is amazing. So, anyway, I'll now give the floor to Dr. McGriggs. We're going to have a couple time reminders, and just before the session ends, I will pop in to say when we have 5 minutes left, and that'll be the last question. So go right ahead, Dr. McGriggs. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks, Malia.
Welcome.
So glad to be here with everyone. I so wish that we were together sharing space, breaking bread, and doing the Sunstone thing. I was going through Facebook and I had notifications like this time last year, and it was all Sunstone. And I just always had really good memories of Sunstone. And I just heard that Aron Moss passed, and it's just, I think that it's just reminders, right? It's reminders when we lose folks that are important in the Mormon studies world or just in the community, just to remember like why we're doing this. And really it comes back to values around valuing and seeing each other, right? And I think that that's the whole purpose of this, is it's to better understand ourselves, to better understand each other, to better understand our relationship to the broader community and society. And so just really rooting ourselves in that. And it's such a tough moment right now. It's a tough moment with COVID. It's a tough moment racially. And I only say that because it's been a tough moment racially, but some people are now just kind of coming to an awareness of that tension, that pain. And it's a tough moment, I think economically for a lot of folks. And so just really sitting with all of that, but holding enough space for ourselves and each other is what I want to be able to do. So we're going to have a hard conversation today, but I hope that in that we can create space for ourselves and each other. I'm going to share my screen and go through some slides. I don't know how much time, you know, I'm going to take, but I'm hoping I can also get through some of this content, but then also get to some questions as well. So I'm looking forward to that. Okay, I'm going to share my screen. And then I'm also going to toggle back and forth because I want to show some videos too. So bear with me. I'm not very tech savvy. I'm a millennial who's bad at technology. So you can't win them all. Okay. I think you should be seeing this now. Oh, here we go. Okay. Again, Dr. Misha McGrigg, she, her. Pronouns, you've heard a little bit about me. That was a wonderful intro. Thank you again, Malia. I appreciate the support on the back end and kind of helping out facilitate this conversation. You've heard about me professionally in my work. It is important to me to kind of socially locate myself so that you understand who's talking at you and you know a little bit about me. So I'll just talk a little bit about myself, just so that you can get to know me a little bit. And I would do this if we were together in person as well, because I do think that's important. So I identify as a Black woman. I do come from an interracial background in that my mom is white, my dad is Black, African-American. And my mom's family goes way back, has pioneer ancestors. She's has British descent, Scottish and English. And so that's was always something that was a part of our family history and our culture was, particularly Scottish culture and knowing our clan and all of that fun stuff. And so that was always really prominent. And then that pioneer history. When I was like 6 or 7, and my grandma, she was the Relief Society president, and she had me come in and sing. I couldn't sing. I can't sing, but I was cute. So, come in and sing a pioneer song, right? You don't have to push a handcart to be a pioneer. And so that was the story, right? That was the story that I was told, right? Is like, we're ancestors, our ancestors are pioneers, right? They crossed the plains. And these stories were just told to us, right? And then, I went on to trek, and I'll talk a little bit about that. And so I was engaged in this very typical kind of Mormon upbringing, this Mormon corridor upbringing. But at the same time, my family was not Utah Mormons, right? They were Montana Mormons. And they like to make that very clear. We're Montana Mormons. And I was like, what's a Montana Mormon, right? What's a Montana Mormon? And I like to say, if I excuse my language, they are damn shit in hell Mormons, right? They're Mormons that are a little more relaxed, very faithful. But if you slip a swear word or, you drink the full caffeine Coke or, there might be someone in the family drinks coffee, right? That's okay. It was like Mormon, but a little rugged. And that was really the way that we were built in our family. And so that was my mom's side, right? Very faithful, but also not so dogmatic, right? And she married my dad. My dad was a convert. He converted to be with my mom. And my dad likes religion, right? So I think he did have some type of a testimony or faith in the gospel, but he likes Jesus and he likes religion and he likes church. So it worked for him for a time. And so here I was with this Black Southern Baptist, kind of like Jesus loving dad, and this white kind of Mormon mom. And I was just trying to navigate the landscape. And I mostly grew up in the Southwest. So Southern California, Orange County, and Phoenix. And we spent a few years in Salt Lake. And so I was surrounded by community and by Mormon community. And that was very much a part of my story. Most of my friends were Mormon, and I had kind of an always that typical Mormon upbringing, right? When I was younger, I thought, I really want to go to BYU. Like, that seems awesome. I'm going to go to BYU. And I didn't go to BYU for my undergrad. For undergrad, it was like, who's going to give you the most scholarship money? State school? Okay, that's where you're going. So I went to Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff, Arizona, and I loved it. I had a great time, and I enjoyed parts of Institute, but there was parts of, you know, that shelf, right, that we know this in this world, right? And a lot of that was things about race and racism, the history. I was also the kid that was independently, like, reading Roots at 9 years old, right? Reading Roots and, you know, whatever, being, like, this little mini activist. And so it was interesting because I had this church experience that really demanded a level of respectability from me that I was quite eager to meet. And I'm going to talk more about that later. But I also, I knew when the story was off, right? Like I felt it, even if I didn't have the language. And that's why I'm so grateful for going to, you know, growing and going to college and finding theory and all of that to be able to place language and theory to my what was happening in my body. So like I said about Trek, you know, I knew this isn't right. If I'd have been the slave, okay, I would have been the slave and in this story. And so something's off. And so my rebellion, without even being able to say that, my rebellion was very somatic. It was very embodied. And I'm going to talk about the body today and the importance of the body, but it was very, my resistance to what was happening around me. I went on Trek. I was like 13 and we went to Martin's Cove and I was like, I was resistant, but you know, I was like the Beehive president. So like, of course I had to go. And you know, they knew that Misha was probably going to like be a little bit annoyed, but that I would go. Right. And, but I would not wear the clothes. And it was funny because last night I was texting Lindsay and I said, Lindsay, and I said, hey, I should have done this presentation in a bonnet, right? To just show, but I don't have a bonnet and I don't know how to sew. So too late, you've got the baseball or the, you know, the cap instead of the bonnet. But just to show that kind of that conflict, right? And I resisted, I wouldn't wear the bonnet and the dress. So I wore a t-shirt that had something about pioneers on it. Like it said like pioneer, right? And so I wore a pioneer t-shirt and I think like a jean skirt, like a longer, like a knee length jean skirt. And I was like, okay, this is how I'll show up. Just knowing that something was off in my body and in my spirit, like the ancestors were whispering, like, this isn't for you, baby. This is not for you. Do not be walking around the desert with these folks telling you something that's not true about where you would have been in the story, right? And so I've been trying for many years to kind of like build my own story and reclaim a story and tell myself a story that's more honest, right? About myself, about whiteness, about the church, about the church's position in relation to whiteness and its relation to people of color. And so that's part of the work. And like I said, the title of this talk is about achieving Zion, right? And what I mean by that, and this is Zion, beautiful, beautiful Zion. I was listening to Lauryn Hill right before this about her song about Zion. Beautiful, beautiful Zion, she talks about. And she's talking about her child that she named Zion. But right, this, what is Zion? But the best version of something. Obviously the church would say like, it's the best version of the church. It is the best version of the saints. It is when God is dwelling with the people, that's Zion. And then when God dwells within you, that is Zion. You are achieving Zion. And so what I would say about Zion is I want us to think about not just the church, like the mainstream LDS church, but what does Mormonism achieving Zion mean? But more importantly, what does yourself achieving Zion mean? You cannot achieve the highest potential, your highest level of righteousness, your highest level of self, if you do not explore and excavate your racial identity. And for the white folks, your whiteness and what that means, right? And so as beautiful as Zion is in this photograph, you can see that it is beautiful. It's also treacherous. And it's treacherous. And what I mean by that is that the terrain is rough and it's been through a lot. So it didn't just come up. It came through, you know, the disruption of tectonic plates. It came up through earthquakes and through flooding and through water and wind and fire. And that is how this beautiful but treacherous place was created. And so our journey to achieving Zion in ourselves and in our communities and in our relationships is going to be treacherous. It will have trauma, right? And it will have trial and stumbling and mistakes and falling down the cliff and trying to get back up. It will have all of that. But if we can get there, right, then we will be encapsulated with a knowing of beauty and a knowing of connection that we've yet to achieve, right, within ourselves and within our communities. So a couple of things. One, I always have to include James Baldwin because I believe he's a prophet. Mormonism has many prophets. And the world of race studies has many prophets. And I would say that James Baldwin is one of them. He says, love takes off the mask that we fear we cannot live without, and we know we cannot live within. I use the word love here not merely in the personal sense, but as a state of being or a state of grace, not in the infantile American sense of being made happy, but in the tough and universal sense of quest and daring and growth. I want to invite you to this labor of love, a labor of love for yourself, to ask yourself to engage in the quest of growth. It's a daring quest of growth, to achieve that growth and liberation, and love of one another, love of each other, right? We cannot have Zion without this journey. And what another thing that James Baldwin says is, it's because I love America so much, more than any other country, that I have to perpetually critique, right? So if you love something, you critique it, you are critical of it, you analyze it, you look at it, you study it, you ponder it, you're curious about it, but you hold it, you create space for it. So I want you to do that with yourself and with whatever version of Mormonism is to you, right? Whether it's actually the pews and the priesthood, or it's just your history and your legacy and your ancestry, right? Whatever it is, hold space for it and space for yourself, but this isn't gonna be easy, okay? And you're somewhere in the journey. Some of you, maybe the first time you're ever gonna hear something like this. Some of you, you've listened to me preach at you, lecture at you before. And for some of you, you've been in this work for a long time, for years, reading, studying, engaged in activism. And so I just say, wherever you are, ashe, ashe, and let's keep moving forward. One of the tools that we're going to use to move through this is going to be our bodies. I come from the kind of theoretically, I come from critical theory, and I'll talk about that. And what that means, but kind of more therapeutically, I come from the somatic trauma lens. And so that means that we center the body. And our body is going to tell us where we have to grow. So as we go through this, I want you, and if we were in a more interactive format, right, I would be asking you to check in. Either in the chat or with each other in some way. But I just want you to take notes to yourself. So I'm going to prompt you to write some things or to reflect on some things as we move through this content. But as you move through every single thing that comes up, as you can remember to do so, I want you to just ask yourself what's coming up in your body, right? Are you feeling your heart beating faster? Are you feeling yourself breathe heavy? Do you sigh? Are you feeling tension in your muscles or tension in your stomach, right? What's coming up as we have these tough conversations? And I want you to know that this is because I love this work. I love so much about my Mormon tradition And I love that you're engaged in this work, and there's probably some of you here that I actually do love. I've had the person that's like, I love you, I don't know you. So that, you know, but I do love this work, and I want you to love this work. And so what that means when you love this work is that it means that we're gonna have tough conversations about institutions of oppression. So we're tough on institutions of oppression, but we're tender with people. And so I want you to know that nothing I'm saying is to attack you, but you may feel that way. And that's because of whiteness. We'll talk about that too. So critical theory helps us with the likes of Horkheimer and Fanon, et cetera. It helps us to orient ourselves to the world around us. It's explanatory theory in nature. And so it tells us what is happening, and primarily tells us about the mechanisms of domination and subordination. And what does power mean? So it tells us the world, about the world and our place in the world based on power dynamics and understanding those things. And then it says, okay, this is the way that it is. And then it is also, so it's descriptive, but it's also prescriptive in saying, I'm going to give you tools for here's how you intervene, because we don't want the world to be about power. And so it does take a position. It says, this is the way that things are, and it's wrong. Systems of oppression are wrong. Power hoarding is wrong. And here's how you intervene. So that's, I want this to be also a reflexive process. So all along the way, you're thinking about yourself in relation to yourself and to others and to your community and to Mormonism, but you're also saying, okay, what would I shift? How would I shift? How would I move, right? So it's gonna require some really deep honesty, but your body's gonna tell you, your body don't lie, okay? Your body does not lie. And if you wanna know more about the way that the body works and how the body tells our story, I would encourage you to read the book, The Body Keeps the Score by Vander Kolk. Okay, so we're gonna move in, right? To the first prompt. First prompt, and I want you to think about this, right? What were you taught about the history of Black folks and the priesthood, right? Or the priesthood and temple ban? What were you taught, either explicitly or implicitly, right? So maybe not directly, maybe you never asked, maybe it was never a Sunday school lesson. But some of you, depending on your age, some of you, depending on where you went on missions, you've certainly maybe have had conversations about this, right? Or maybe just in social settings, right? Someone asks you like, yeah, you're racist church? Okay, so I just want you to think about that. I want you to think about that. Maybe just jot it down if you have a note, if you have a notepad or if you're keeping notes on the computer. Just what we taught. I was taught that the time wasn't right, and then the Lord changed his mind, and it was. We don't know why, you'll figure it out in the next life. Line upon line, precept on precept, we don't know anything, or we can't know everything until we become gods ourselves, and so when we get there, we're with God, yay us, and we'll be told what's up. Not very satisfactory. But here's the catch. You had to be super righteous to get there to be with God in order to ask. So that's how they hooked me, right? Be really righteous and then you'll get a no. But if you mess it up and you're sinful and you don't go to the celestial kingdom, you'll never know why this happened. And this was my thing, right? I really was I was disturbed. I didn't understand it. And I tried to reconcile it, make sense of it, but I just kind of fell on, well, I guess that's the way that it was, and we don't really know. And, you know, I was looking through the scriptures like, well, you know, only Aaron had the priesthood. Maybe that's something to do with it, right? I'm digging, right? I'm really grappling and reconciling and wrestling in a way, right, that white people necessarily don't have to do. But Black people have to wrestle with this if it comes into our awareness, particularly African-Americans. Other people have different experiences, but African-Americans really have to wrestle with this when they joined the church. Now, I was born into the church, so it was just like, here you go, right? But I still had to go through that because I needed to, if you're born wrong, right? We don't even believe necessarily being born into sin in the way Catholics do or other folks do, but we do believe that for Black people. You're just born wrong. You're born not worthy. You're born unrighteous. You're born immature, spiritually immature, underdeveloped. So, whew, that's a heavy burden. And so you're constantly trying not to just be able to like enjoy the gospel, right? Or enjoy your youth activity, enjoy the blessings of the gospel. You're also having to really reconcile with and grapple with these things. So I want you to think about, When was the first time or what were you taught, right? And when do you remember being taught? Okay. Or when did it come up, right? Maybe you never was on your radar, but again, you were on your mission and someone asked you, okay? Or you were in a college class and what it came up, right? Okay. I like to call Eliza a prophetess. She was pretty impactful. I think people would say she's prophetic. You could see I use that term more broadly than maybe a mainstream LDS term, but this is part of her poem. It's a long poem. I was going to read the whole thing, but it's not great. So I'll just give you a portion of it. Called The New Year. She wrote it in 1852. Reformers and reforms now in our own United States, clashing tornado-like are threatening dissolution all around. Slavery and anti-slavery. What a strife. Japhet shall dwell within the tents of Shem, and Ham shall be his servant. Long ago the prophet said, 'Tis being now fulfilled. The curse of the Almighty rests upon the colored race. Oh, Eliza. She was quite the unapologetic racist and white supremacist. And foot soldier for the patriarchy. She also talks about how bad women's suffrage is in the same poem and has a lot to do with influencing the men, particularly John Taylor, right, about his thoughts about women and the priesthood. So some people really love her. I like to complicate that narrative because I think she's complex. I don't think she's off limits of critique. And actually, because she's so... she is that early woman that had so much power. I think hard power and soft power she had. And because that power and her influence has a legacy that we still revere and value, then I think that she must be critiqued, just like the prophets are. If we're going to critique Brigham Young, then we need to critique Eliza R. Snow. So there are some of our things that we were taught, right? I want to go through some of the other things. Okay, so from, and sorry about this being text heavy, I apologize. Let's just start with the scripture. And he caused the cursing to come upon them, yea, even a sore cursing because of their iniquity. For behold, they had hardened their hearts against him, and that they had become like unto a flint. Ooh. Wherefore, as they, flint, that's really a powerful imagery. Wherefore, as they were white and exceedingly fair and delightsome, ooh, yes, white and delightsome, that they might not be enticing unto my people, the Lord God did cause a skin of blackness to come upon them. 2 Nephi 5:21. Now, this is a scripture that some folks, even some other Black Mormon folks, will try to reconcile or interpret differently, but I'll just say the way I receive that is pretty straightforward. Okay, so Joseph Smith's first missions were Indian missions. He was peddling the Book of Mormon to the indigenous people in the United States of America. They didn't buy it. Those missions were not very successful. He didn't get very many converts because Native Americans, indigenous people in this country, knew their history through their oral histories. They had an oral tradition that said, this is your history, these are your people, this is your God, this is your understanding of spirit and self. And it was not what this white man was peddling in this book. And so it was quite rejected. But it's interesting, if he's saying, this is your history, this is your sin, you've got to repent, I've got the keys for you to be able to restore yourself from your sin. And he's peddling it to people of color, right? Then I don't see the need to make it a metaphor, right? I think that it's pretty straightforward, right? What's going to appeal to somebody? I've got the recipe for your salvation.
Misha.
So, okay, so let's go through. So there's where we are kind of in our doctrine, right? For better or for worse. grapple with that. Let's go back. Let's see what Joseph Smith said.
Misha, so we're 30 minutes in now, just so you know.
Okay, great. Thank you. So what did Joseph say? So Joseph said many things. So Joseph is often touted as like the anti-racist prophet, right? It all went wrong after Brigham. Well, let's back up to Joseph. Are Mormons abolitionists? No, unless delivering the people from priestcraft and the priests from the power of Satan should be considered abolition. But we do not believe in setting the Negro free. Okay, so there you go. That's Joseph's position. And he has said it many times, right? So even though he ran for president on a free ticket, he basically also said, like, yeah, like, if there's free Negroes, that's fine. Cool, they can come. And we know he had a close relationship with Black members of the church. We know his relationship with Jane Manning James. But that didn't mean that he thought that he should be telling Southerners what to do with their slaves. And he said that. I would never tell, Northerners should not be telling Southerners what to do with their slaves, because that would be getting in someone else's business, right? You don't go to someone's business and say, here's what you need to do with your business. He's not gonna do that. He's not gonna get in other grown men's business. This is how the Southern economy is worked, right? He's not gonna do that, right? So there we go. And then let's go to Brigham Young. Who has said many, many things, but this is a good one. You must not think from what I say that I am opposed to slavery. No, the Negro is damned and is to serve his master till God chooses to remove the curse of him. Okay, so that's pretty clear, right? You know, Brigham Young was not a fan of intermixing, and actually, you know, a Black man who had intermarried that was, you know, actually, T. Walker Lewis's son, right, married a white person in polygamy. And after, I mean, that really didn't sit well with Brigham Young, right? That did not sit well with him, okay? And some scholars would say that that's kind of the impetus for the ban. There's debate, but certainly that happened and he was not a fan. Okay, let's see what Ezra Taft Benson said about the civil rights movement. There is no doubt that the so-called civil rights movement, as it exists today, is used as a communist program for revolution in America. Okay, so we know President Benson was very anti-civil rights. He thought Dr. King was like evil communist, right? So I love how the church likes to kind of reclaim and say, and we'll talk about what this is when the church tries to get engaged in this type of revisionist history, but they try to be like, we love Dr. King. You didn't when he was around. Let's see what N. Eldon Tanner said also the same year. The church has no intention of changing its doctrine on the Negro. Throughout the history of the original Christian church, the Negro never held the priesthood. There's really nothing we can do to change this. It's a law of God. Okay, again. So we're going to blame God, and we've got a history of blaming God. We've got it built into the scriptures to be able to justify it. And so then we can go, it's not us. Not us. It's God. And then, Professor Bott. I don't know. He could be here at Sunstone. I don't know. But Professor Bott from BYU in 2008 said, in reality, the Blacks not having the priesthood was a greatest blessing God could give them. Okay, so again, this mythology, right, is maintained, and it's still present. Okay, so now I'm gonna share with you a video, a couple videos. The first video is, I think, just fantastic for maybe how things were for a lot of folks. Oopsie. Okay.
Listen, I have to ask you something that I know that you have heard about, and if I don't ask it, people will wonder why I didn't. And that is, in the strength of your religion, the whole business about Blacks not being allowed to be priests in the Mormon religion.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me how you feel about it and what the explanation for that is, would you, Donnie?
You bet. Well, I'm not an authority on the subject, but I will mention that we are not prejudiced people. We offer more, I think, than any other religion to the Black person. And if you really want a good explanation, and someone who has an authority about it should really talk to the general authorities of our church. Mm-hmm. They are not allowed to hold the priesthood in this right now, and I don't know why, but that's the way the Lord wants it.
Now, I have noticed here that you have no trouble speaking your mind, and yet, you know, in the church feeling about it, it seems to me it's that the woman is somewhat in the secondary position.
Secondary, no. But you have to remember that you need a patriarch at the head of the home, and this is the way that I feel. You need someone to run the home. The woman is equally as important. But as far as speaking her mind, that should be the man's job.
Okay. So, I just want you to just reflect on anything that's come up in your body as I read those quotes, or as you heard this video of Donnie and Marie, right? So, Donnie and Marie are obviously the most, well, maybe not now because of Mitt Romney, but like, you know, for longevity wise, they were the most famous Mormons, right? And this is pre-78. And Donnie has the audacity, right, to say that we give, you know, blacks more than anybody else. Woo! Pre-78. So I don't know what they'd say today, maybe something different, but I just want to take, and if you were alive during this time, think back, right? Maybe you saw that interview. What did you think at the time? Maybe you saw it live. And maybe you thought, yeah, and you could see they're both nervous. They're having some type of a reaction to it because I don't think they fully believe it either. And yet they will say it, right? And so, because, I mean, they're not saying it with much conviction, right? I mean, they're just kind of like, well, you know, but it's still really damaging, right? Still very damaging. Okay. So as you think about what comes up in your body, as we went through those quotes, and as, you heard Donnie and Marie, right? Kind of these icons, representations, that meeting of Mormons and mainstream world, and the tension of that relationship historically. I just want you to sit with that in your body, right? Now, I'm going to shift our perspective a little bit, and I want to do that through James Baldwin. So I think you can still see my screen, and I just toggled over to James Baldwin. So I'm going to start this video. I want you to listen carefully, and I want you to just think of what comes up in your body, reflect on it, and because he's gonna say something that's pretty intense. So I'll just let you know that now.
Where the white culture has operated and has operated deliberately to demoralize all black people, and the demoralization has in many cases been fatal, and in all cases has been sinister. The effort, therefore, that I must make to arrive at my identity is mainly in opposition to the white force of the world. Under such a tension, it becomes very difficult, and then under such a tension, I must repeat, it becomes absolutely necessary to deal with people as people, only as people. Because you cannot spend your life, this is my point, trying to be revenged for historical crimes. If you do that, you will destroy yourself and you will perpetuate the crime. The thing to aim at, this is why it is a terrible necessity to accept white people, but it's a terrible necessity on the part of white people, even harder necessity to accept Negroes, because in order for white people to accept a Negro, they've got to accept their history and something much deeper and worse than that. They got to accept, if I may now be brutal and rude, but I mean this and you must think about it. If you remember that everything that you will do all your life and everything that you will say reveals you, what I call you, doesn't say anything about you, or very rarely. But what I call you says everything about me. Now, there is a very good reason, which has nothing to do with Negroes, why white people call them nigger. It's a white invention. And in order for white people to be released from this invention, they will have to discover where this nigger really lives. And he lives inside white people. And they had to accept him, that stranger within, before they can accept anybody without. That is what I was trying to say.
Let me just take a breath on that. Okay. I want us to consider, right, that perhaps this is all projection, right? That those quotes, the beliefs, the mythologies, right? Perhaps those are the insecurities of white Mormons, of white Mormonism, of Mormonism. Shortcomings, the shortcomings of the gospel projected onto the black body as our shortcomings, our infantileness, right? Our unrighteousness. Shift and say perhaps these are projections from our own, my own, the church's own insecurity, lack, fallibility. Just a shift. So, Freud calls it the id. Jung calls it the shadow side or the shadow archetype, right? But it's this unconscious part of ourselves. What is that, right? If we think of the church or Mormonism or our white self, right? The white church, white Mormonism, white self, right? What is it? Perhaps, like James Baldwin said, this is the ugliness within that has to be reconciled. And as opposed to continuing to project it out onto the black body, bring it into consciousness and grapple with it, wrestle with it, look at it, examine it, move it into a different space. Don't allow it to live there unconsciously festering, because what's being projected out is violence, weaponization, hatred, right? And all of those ego defenses that come up, right, when we talk about these things are not uncommon. That's kind of how the way that this is built, right? We feel defensive, maybe we feel like that's not true for us, that's like, or we make excuses, or we try to, or we feel guilty, or we feel shame, right? All those things, those are part of it, but I would ask us to push through that and allow us to sit with this ugliness a little while longer, right? Because I've had to sit with this mythology, not just the mythology of Mormonism and its view, right? But with the mythology of racism as we know it today, the mythology that the white race is superior, white supremacy, right? And that the black race is the most inferior, that it has less value, less humanity. And I can reject that mythology, right? In my mind, I can decolonize my mind. I can liberate myself inside. But what happens when I take that mythology and then I am raised in an environment that says, God said it. Now it's not just, well, some, you know, problematic, racist, fake news scientists said it a long time ago back in Europe, but now we're projecting it and we're putting it onto God and we're making it God's fault. And how does that change things, right? And what I want to ask the next prompt is, as we think about everything we've talked about and we take a breath, I want to ask you, what's the first time you interacted with a black person at church? What was the interaction? Who was the person? What was the interaction? How did you feel about it, right? The first time I interacted with a black person at church, besides my dad, my parents divorced when I was young, so I didn't go to church often with my dad, but like my dad baptized me, and when he would visit, he would come to church with me. And sometimes I would go to church with him if I, you know, if he was going to the church at the moment. But outside of that, outside of my dad, the first person I remember interacting with at church was the non-member husband of a woman in our ward. There was a white woman in our ward, and she had a black husband. He wasn't a member, but he would come to church sometimes, and he would always come in really bright colored suits. And I did not understand why he dressed that way. He stood out like a sore thumb. He just did, you know the way we dress, and you know when someone is not a member how they dress. And we know, right? We have all these signalings to each other about ways in which we are trying to belong or who belongs and who doesn't. And he certainly didn't belong, right? But I just remember that and thinking like, ooh, I wish he would come dressed like us. I remember wanting him to conform and assimilate, right? Because I knew he was making black or white people uncomfortable, right? And they were kind. White people are very nice. So they were nice. No one was rude, right? But he didn't belong. And we all knew that. So what was the first time? Was it a convert? And what was the conversation? And was it someone you were teaching that you baptized? Was it a leader? I wonder if anyone has ever had a first interaction with a black person in church be your bishop or be your Sunday school teacher or be your elders quorum president or be your relief society president. I'm betting that's probably more rare. Were you in a position over them, right? And what did you think? Did you think, oh, like, they're going to be great once we get them on board, right? Once they figure out the dress code and they figure out how we pray and how we sing, they're going to be great. Just think about that. There's a term that's called racial anxiety. Racial anxiety is why it's hard to talk about race and racism. And essentially what racial anxiety comes down to is the physiological response that we have to these conversations. That's why I've asked you to be aware of your body and then asked you to breathe. Because as you breathe, particularly if you do like a nice belly breath, you are coming back into from that kind of fight or flight or shutdown mode back into your front part of your brain where you can use all of your executive functioning and all of your full faculties. It is hard. We shut down, right? And I think part of it is that we shut down because we are having this, you know, this response to worrying about, I think for white people it's hard because we're worried about being called racist, right? White folks don't want to be called racist, right? But I actually believe that it's more about this shadow side. What is it about you that may be revealed or exposed when you're in this conversation or you're in a racial dynamic? For black and brown people, it tends to be that we are afraid of retaliation or violence in some way if we talk about these topics. But this is not just worry or concern. This is very physiological. Your body and your brain is responding to this. But I was trying to think like, what makes Mormonism different, right? And how does racial anxiety show up for Mormons? In the white Mormon body, in the white Mormon church, what does that look like? What is Mormon racial anxiety? And so a few features before we kind of get further into it, a few features are that what makes it Mormon is that we're sharing a history and a culture. And what does sharing mean? Sharing, when you have a share in something, that means that you're invested. Like if I have a share, if I own a share of a company, I am invested in that. I'm invested in that. I expect that there's going to be some type of return upon my investment. And if that is disrupted, what am I getting and what am I not getting, right? So these mythologies, these false doctrines, the mythologies, the stories, the hyperbole, all of that stuff, right? We invest in it because it does something for us. And what does it do? Is it protects us from our shame. It protects us from our moral sin. Racial anxiety for Mormons is a fear of moral sin. It's a fear of imperfection, of having imperfect leadership, of having ourselves be imperfect in ways that we don't even know, in ways we can't even access because they're unconscious, right? And so there's race studies scholars who will talk about the possessive investment in whiteness. And I love the reframe that Joanna Brooks gives us in her latest book. She gives us a few great terms that I'm going to talk about, but one of them is the possessive investment in rightness. We know that we have a possessive investment in being right. Mormonism has to be right. If we're the only true church, it has to be right. And if I left the church, then I have to be right and it has to be wrong. So I'm still invested in being right. That's your Mormonism. I'm invested in me being right and them being wrong, right? Whichever side of the spectrum you're on, we're invested in this rightness. We're invested in this perfection, this perfect knowledge of things. And one of the ways that we've gotten there is through Black abstraction. So if we abstract Black people from the history, from the story, then we can create whatever mythology we want that satisfies that need and blocks us from the shame and from our sin. Right? So that Black abstraction is, here's a historical moment for you. When Elijah Abel was, who was a Black Mormon, early Black Mormon during the pioneer times, he was baptized, he was ordained to the priesthood, he was made a 70. There are records of it, and we know, right? Now, one of the people who knew that he was ordained was Abraham Smoot. So Smoot was there, Zebedee Coltrane did the blessing, anointed him with the priesthood, and Smoot was there. So they know that Black people were in the story, right? When J. Manning James, who was an accountability partner for the church and for these white men, when she died, they completely changed. That's when they changed the story. They went, no, Elijah Abel, he wasn't, no. There were no people that were baptized. There were no people that were ordained to the priesthood. No Black men were ordained to the priesthood. They didn't have that Black accountability. So if you abstract Blackness, then you can claim innocence. We just didn't know. There just weren't any Black people around. We had no idea. So when you abstract them, and that's a beautiful analysis that we get from her book, if you extract them from the story, then you can create whatever story you want that will grant you innocence, absolution, and ignorance, right? Not our fault, it's God's fault. We don't understand, we're innocent, right? Moving to Missouri was not de facto. There's no such thing as de facto segregation, okay? So moving to Missouri was not, well, we're just gonna go to Missouri, right? We moved to Missouri because we knew they were a slave state. We knew Black people weren't gonna go there. The last thing we needed, this church that's trying to find its power, that's trying to find its whiteness, right, in and of itself, right? The last thing we need is a bunch of Black people cramping our style and ruining our rep. So let's move to Missouri, where they're slave territory, slave state. Black people won't want to come there, and we're not going to protect them when they get there. So if they want to come, that's on you, right? Again, we don't tell people what to do with their slaves. New York City is the most segregated school district in America. That is not de facto. It's very strategic. That happened through redlining, that happened through policy, right? So nothing is just, it happens. This is all very much built into an agenda for power, right? So the other thing that we ask and is part of racial anxiety is signaling. We ask for Black people to signal to us so we can be comfortable. Because if we're uncomfortable, then we have to deal with our shame, then we might have to think of ourselves as imperfect. We gotta be comfortable. And so the way that we do that is we ask Black people to signal to us that they are with the program, that they are correlated, that they are assimilated, and that they engage in a certain level of respectability. And we actually ask that through documentation. So Elijah Abel had to carry his priesthood papers with him. That's not his priesthood paper, that's a freedom paper. But he had to carry his priesthood paper. And that priesthood paper said, I was ordained on this day by this person, and it's signed by Joseph Smith, who said, yep, it happened. He had to do that to prove who he was. We ask that of him, and we continue to ask that of Black people. So the Mormon version of freedom papers were, if you were Black in the North, you had to have a paper that said, I was born free, or I was freed on this day, I bought my freedom, I was freed by this person on this day. And at any moment, any white person could ask you, let me see your papers. And we understand this today, right? We ask for documentation from people. And it's happening at the border and with the Latinx community right now. But our version of freedom papers, let me see your papers, let me see that you belong, is asking for these priesthood papers. And what are the papers that we demand from Black members? Or just from Black people in our lives, right? We demand that they dress a certain way, or do certain things for us, right? I was speaking, and we all were speaking. I understand, we all spoke young in church, but I was speaking at the pulpit very, very young, and more often than other kids, because I knew that that was a way that if I could inspire and engage the spirit, invoke the spirit, and speak eloquently and intelligently from the time I was 9, 10. I wasn't giving youth talks and sacrament at 12, 13. I was giving them at 10, 11. Because I knew that it would buy me respect. Every piece of me that was less valuable, I had to fill that in with some paper that I had to show. I had to deliver something. So I delivered here's how smart I am. I can talk about the scriptures. I've got them memorized, right? I had so many scriptures memorized, and I knew the gospel. I knew the doctrine better than anyone in my family, quite honestly. My family, again, Montana Mormons, they weren't intellectuals. They weren't combing over. They certainly weren't coming to Sunstone and really thinking deeply. They're just, oh yeah, sounds good. It works for us. Cool, right? But I did. I grappled, right? And I could deliver, right? And I could entertain. When I was at girls' camp, I was the show. I was giving the jokes. And I talk about this. I wrote a chapter about this in Decolonizing Mormonism, the book by Gina Colvin and John Brooks. I write about this, about how I had to kind of signal my belonging. And as long as I entertained, I inspired, I didn't disrupt, I served deferently. I had a reputation around the neighborhood when I was in middle school, like when I was 13, I had a reputation for being like the best babysitter. I don't even like kids, but man, I figured out how to be the best babysitter. I'm an only child. So like, who's gonna let an 11-year-old only child watch their kids? Mormons in Utah and in Arizona who were frugal. That's true. But anyway, I had a reputation for being a really good babysitter. And I was known for, if you were going to the temple, I wouldn't take your money. So if your date night was to the temple, I wouldn't take your money.
Misha, we have about half an hour left.
Great. So these are all the ways in which I would do things to try to gain, like, see me as worthy, church. And people were not mean to me. People loved me because I entertained, I taught, and I served. Right. Even though it was awful inside, I did that to try to gain a place in Zion. I want us to think about the ways in which these myths, this history, and this reality of racism, of white supremacy, is keeping us disconnected from each other and disconnected from ourselves, right? Keeping us in conflict. Let me tell you something. Everybody died in the Book of Mormon. Everybody died because they could not figure out how to get along, right? And I would say race was a factor. They couldn't figure out how to coexist in these different racialized bodies. Couldn't figure it out. They all died. Everybody died. Everybody was wiped off the earth. So think about that, right? What are the pieces of ourselves that we're killing off or that are we're in conflict with constantly? And who are we trying to kill off, right? But what pieces of our history so that we can claim innocence, so that we don't have to experience that shame and that fear of our own imperfection? Face that id, that ugliness inside of each of us. I said in the title or in the abstract of the paper that we needed to have repentance and reparations and reconciliation, right? This is a process we have to engage. Not just so that we can go to church, right? But for our own actualization, right? Whether we're in the church or not, right? The church has to do its own work. And so I call on the church as an institution to look at these things, but as each of us individually also, right? So we've got to unpack this discomfort. The discomfort is the edge of our growing. Lean into it. Learn into your discomfort. That wherever you're uncomfortable, be curious. That's the time to pick up a book. That's the time to really dig in deeper. Face that shadow side. What is the parts of me that I don't like that I'm projecting onto others, onto the black body, right? Or parts of my own church or my own church history, right? That are ugly. Confess. So once you face that, you have to confess with your mouth. You have to say the thing, right? And I think that's why in some ways, Joanna's book is riling some people up, is because she's saying it. She's putting the words on paper, right? Very directly. But we have to confess this with our mouths. And we have to commit to improving. So once we know it, then we say it, then we commit to improving. We say, we're going to do better. We're going to learn what it means to engage in anti-racist work. We're going to learn what it means to be racially equitable. We're gonna learn what do our brothers and sisters need from us and what do we need from ourselves, right? We're gonna commit to that improving. We're gonna seek accountability. Build yourself in an accountability partner. Don't allow the accountability partner to be Jane. It's not her job. And if Jane isn't looking or I'm not looking or your black friend isn't looking, what are you doing? And how are you holding yourself accountable with other white trusted, educated accountability partners? How do we build that into the structures of the church? And how do we build that into the structures of our own lives and families, right? So think about that. And if you need resources on that, I'm happy to give those. Healthy communities, this is the last thing I wanna say. Repentant, healthy communities are not perfect. Just like a healthy relationship, most of you are probably married. You know that a healthy marriage is not one that is devoid of all conflict. You have conflict. You have argumentation. You have battles. That doesn't mean your relationship is not healthy. What it means is that your relationship is being real, right? That you have conflict. So healthy relationships do have conflict. Healthy communities have conflict, but they stay engaged. They commit to being there. They commit to the dialogue. Now, if it's abusive, that's something else. If it's abusive, leave, right? And that's why I would say, if Mormonism is abusive to you, you have every right to leave, right? But what I would say is healthy communities and how we move toward that, having a healthy community is to have one that stays in dialogue. And in therapy, we call it having a holding space or creating a holding space. I don't have all the answers as your therapist, but I can hold whatever you bring. And we're gonna sit here together for as long as it takes. I'm committed to being in this space with you. And that is a repentant, reparative, healthy community. We create holding spaces for each other. We create holding spaces for the ways in which we have weaponized and been traumatic to and been violent toward people of color, particularly African-Americans in our church, right? And we sit together with that. And I'll say this. This is the last thing I'll say. For people who, here's my truth bomb. For people who have left the church, for ex-Mormons, You do not get to claim, I left the church because it's so racist and that's why I can't be there because it's so racist, if you are not going to do the work to explore and excavate and look at and face your own shadow side. If you're not going to look at the ways in which you have engaged in white supremacy and the ways you're positioned in white supremacy and your own white privilege, you do not get to say, I left the church because it's too racist. Okay? Because you never experienced that racism. So you don't get to shield yourself and use my black body, right, as a critique of the church if you're not going to do your own work. Okay? So whether you're in the pews, you're out of the pews, you're down in Short Creek right now, you're wherever you are and wherever you are in your journey, I just want to invite you to really commit to being there, to making repentance so that you can actualize your community and actualize your greatest potential within yourself. Thank you so much. I'm going to stop sharing so that I can look at the questions and comments. But I thank you, and I hope that even if just one small thing crystallized today, I call that a win. So appreciate you being here and listening. Okay, let's look here.
Thank you. So everyone, we have about half an hour for the Q&A. Sorry, Misha, didn't interrupt you. So Misha is going to go ahead and answer the ones that are already in there, but I encourage you to put them in now because you do have a pretty big queue if you do have a question you would like her to address. Go ahead, Misha.
Also, Malia, did I ever get back to sharing the rest of the PowerPoint?
Nope. No, what? we were looking at YouTube for a while, but that's all right.
Okay, let me pull that up.
Okay.
I'm sorry, you guys. And I just saw your message. Okay.
That's all right. We're all enjoying it. That was a really great presentation. Thank you.
That's just me freaking talking and you're not even seeing what's going on. Okay. So now you see my PowerPoint?
Yes, we do.
Okay. Let me just run through these slides so you can see what I was saying. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, there we go. Little shadow side. Question about that. Mormon racial anxiety, if you want to look at any of those notes there. That for a second. Priesthood papers and freedom papers. That's a picture of a freedom paper. That's Elijah Abel. What papers do you demand, right? It's me on the left and some early Mormon folk. Nephites and Lamanites being disconnected and worn with each other, and then they all died, right? And then the steps toward reparation, reconciliation. Okay. Sorry about that. Oh my gosh. Okay, let me look at the questions now. All right. Someone just said that there's a comment that they've had a historical crush on Eliza, but the more that they learn, it gets super complicated, and I don't think I'll bring her home to my parents. That's really funny. Yeah, no, I hear you. But I actually like complicated people. I think that gives us humanity. So I hear that, and I'd say, like, we get humanity out of that. Yeah, there's parallels with the LGBT community. Someone said those passages against the priesthood ordination are exactly today's LGBTQ+, but I would say that we haven't actually resolved white supremacy and racism in the church, and so I would allow those to be their own, and certainly they intersect whenever you're talking about like black or brown queer people, but I would allow those to be their own issues within the church, and I know there's parallels, but until we can really get it together with white supremacy, we don't want to kind of derail the conversation to kind of queer issues, because not necessarily derail, we don't want to switch, because then we'll be over there and then kind of racism continues to kind of fester and grow. But I hear that, and the parallels are important, and the intersections are really important. Oh, I gave a course earlier in the month, and I'm not sure, someone asked how many people they thought were LDS that attended my course. It was a broad course about racism. I'm not sure. There were a lot of people on my social media that attended, I think, but and a lot of those are connected to the church, but I'm not sure the numbers. Getting some love, that's great. Book of Moses and someone said Book of Moses and Book of Abraham are far more explicitly white supremacist than Book of Mormon. Sure, and I think that is, I think that's accurate. And I would say that now, and the reason why I use quotes from the Book of Mormon, right, is because now we question Book of Moses and Abraham a little bit more. They get more scrutiny. We don't scrutinize the Book of Mormon in the same way, but certainly, and the other thing there is, right, it's like those are the writings of Joseph, right, writings of Joseph. So I think that, I think that that's reflective of his own, right, thoughts in some ways. Is Zion a realistic end state? Someone asked. In that, right, it's not perfect. It's treacherous. It's tumultuous. But it stays in conversation, in dialogue, and it keeps repenting, doing better, recommitting. It stays in that space. Just like like that relationship kind of metaphor, right? Like, it's not perfect, but we're committed to doing better. And that's Zion to me. That's potential. And you will have beauty, like that picture of Zion Park, but it is not without its treacherous and mountainous terrain. Can you give us a 101 book list to help us begin to understand these issues? I sure can. I would highly recommend, for more of the Mormonism story, I would recommend Joanna Brooks' book, White Supremacy and Mormonism. I would also suggest Paul Reeves' book, Religion of a Different Color, to understand kind of some of the racialized history of the Mormon church. I would also say on the Mormon side of things, if you're looking to kind of come at the Book of Mormon, or at least the first part of the Book of Mormon, from a liberation theology standpoint, Black liberation theology, then I would get Fatima Saleh's new book, Spit and Mud, where she really expands and reimagines the Book of Mormon from a kind of a trauma perspective. It's fantastic. On the secular side, I would say the first book I would recommend is, I would say read The Fire Next Time by James Baldwin. I just think if you start there, I mean, that's really a culmination of what we're talking about. So I would say that, but it's a little, it's short, it's an easy read, but it's also a lot to grapple with. If you would want to have the vocabulary first, I would suggest So You Want to Talk About Race by Oluo, O-L-U-O. So You Want to Talk About Race. I would also suggest White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. I would also suggest, if you want to understand like the economics and redlining, I would suggest two books, one by Mormonism's own Mercer Baradaran on the color of money, black banks and the racial wealth gap. I would suggest that book to really understand how did this economy was built on racism. And then to understand redlining, it's called The Color of Law. The Color of Law. And I forget who wrote that. I think it's Rothstein. Those are some books that I would suggest. If any others come to mind, I will loop back. Someone said, your words on signaling have helped me realize I try to get Black, Indigenous, people of color to signal to me they approve of me and see my wokeness. And that I'm not like other white people. Do you see this commonly? Yes, in the progressive community all the time. So the signaling goes back and forth, right? It's like, I wanna signal I'm a safe white person. Like, I'm down, I'm woke, I get it. And I understand the desire to do that, right? But it's quite performative, and I would rather you just engage in the work, right? So it means that no one needs to see it. I was talking to somebody the other day, an organization that said, like, we're pretty white, and we would love to be more diverse, but I just don't know if that's going to happen. But we want to be an equitable place, right? We want to be, we want to root out our racism. We want to dismantle white supremacy in our space. And I said, yeah. I said, that's the most important thing, right? The most important thing is you working on your white supremacy. That's more important than getting your numbers up. Because if you haven't changed anything about your culture and your climate in your organization, but you've brought in more black and brown bodies, then all you're going to be doing is making more mistakes and having them have to do more labor. They're going to have face more microaggressions, et cetera, et cetera. So what I would say is, if you become, right, or you work toward becoming a, I don't like to say safe places, but like a safer or a more deconstructed white person, that the natural consequence of that is that black and brown people and indigenous folk will want to be in relationship with you, as opposed to you seeking out those things or seeking to prove or chasing after them, chasing us. I would just say, just do your work and it will be seen. Dr. King used to talk about that he really valued the UU church. And the UU church is super white, super white. They're still super white and super wealthy. They're not really a diverse space. But for whatever reason, they had done the work to where he felt welcome in their space. And to me, that's more important than if there's actually people in your space. It's that if we did come, that what we would receive when we were there was a welcoming, not just welcoming, but a critical space, a space that's working on this, a space that's critically analyzing itself and doing better, right? So a few more things here. Oh, thanks, someone recommended my course, thank you. What content creators, podcast journalists would be good to follow to understand the current events? Sure, so I would start with the 1619 podcast from the New York Times. I would follow Michael Harriet from The Root. Ta-Nehisi Coates. Oh, that's the other book I would really recommend, Ta-Nehisi Coates, Between the World and Me. Fantastic book, but he's also just always kind of doing really great stuff, from Case for Reparations to My President Used to Be Black to a lot of great, he'll do long stories in different outlets. Let's see, other content creators. There's a YouTube channel called Decoded. It's by MTV. And it's really great. They do short videos on topics of race and racism. Other podcasts. Code Switch is a great podcast. If I think of more, I'll come back to that as well.
Hey, Nisha, could I ask a question? It's a moderator's privilege.
Sure, please.
I haven't read it, but I know a lot of my white friends are reading White Fragility, and it seems to have made its way into more of a mainstream position rather than just kind of being for people who are trying to, like you said, it's very nicely to do the work. I'm seeing a lot of suburban folks reading that have previously not been involved, trying to understand, honestly, the Black Lives Movement. So can you speak a little bit about, like, that book and what it's about? Like, for those of us that want to recommend it or read it, we know what we're getting.
Sure. So Robin DiAngelo, certainly, and you said White Fragility, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, I'm putting the speaker up so I can hear you. So White Fragility is certainly not the first exploration of whiteness by any means. There have been white scholars and black scholars that have been talking about whiteness for a long time. Basically, she really does a good job using critical theory, critical race theory, to unpack what the culture, the norms, and the kind of automatic movements of whiteness are. And so she really talks about what is it, what is the white body, and how is it positioned. She talks about herself growing up as a poor child of a single mother, and the how oftentimes race and class are conflated, and how she wants to unpack that and look at all the things that, that she had access to because she was white, even though she was poor. She really talks a lot about kind of unpacking white privilege. And what she's trying to do is she talks about shifting the lens. So she says, when you shift the lens of what you understand what it means to be racist, then you shift kind of the dialogue, right? And but what she also says is, you know, if you shift the lens and you gain a new understanding, but you don't act on that, then you're colluding, right? And so the collusion, the denial, all of that in that Mormon version would be that innocence, it claiming, I just didn't know, oh no. But once you know better, you have to do better. You're called on to do better. So she's really invoking people to shift their lens, to understand the way that whiteness operates and the way that you operate and benefit from your whiteness and how you can use that as a weapon and probably have been complicit in white supremacy in one way or the other, and then how to start to shift and do something different. Two other books I would recommend that come to mind, White Rage, by Carol Anderson, White Rage, yes. And then The New Jim Crow to Understand Incarceration, The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander is also a great book. Did that answer, Malia, your question on white fragility?
Yeah, absolutely, thanks.
Yeah, and I'll say this about Robin. I'm not big on like white people being the face of this work. I do believe that it's the job of white people to dismantle white supremacy. Black people are busy trying to survive and thrive. But I want you to do the work, but I'm not big on them being like, oh yeah, the go-to people are like getting super wealthy. But here's what I'll say about Robin. Not to, you know, there's plenty of critiques that I think are important about Robin, but I will say that she has accountability partners. She has white accountability partners. She also has Black accountability partners that she pays. So if she ever talks to someone and she just needs the Black perspective on it, or she thinks there's something she's not seeing, she pays for the time and the labor of Black people to educate her. She will not ask them to do labor for her for free. And she lives off of her book sales. That pays her bills. But her workshops and any trainings that she does, that money goes back into Black-owned or Black-run organizations. So I like that because she keeps herself accountable and keeps her kind of money where her mouth is. So that's one good thing. Let's go. Oh, My Grandmother's Hands is another great book. My Grandmother's Hands. Okay, there was like maybe one more. Okay, so this is a good place to kind of end. Can you give an example of being a white ally in the church? If I'm not in leadership, should I suggest people of color to be in leadership? If we don't have people of color in the congregation, what can I do to be an ally in the realm of religion? Okay, so I'm gonna break down the term ally first, just because I think it is not, I think it's more passive. So I really want you to think of yourself as a co-conspirator or a comrade, right? That's a little more active, like you're in this battle together, right? Think of yourself as a stripling warrior against white supremacy. If you're in the pews, if you're in church, if you hear some junk, disrupt it. If you hear mythology, disrupt it. Say it out loud. That's not right, right? If you see microaggressions happening, disrupt it, right? I think you should push for a fifth Sunday lessons to be talks about requests for there to be talks about either looking at the paper that the church put out about the priesthood ban, right? Ask to grapple with that. Ask to have someone teach a lesson on that. Use your fifth Sunday to do anti-racist studies, right? Try to get the fifth Sunday or Sunday school to be about this history, right? Maybe you could even convince someone to present on Joanna's book or on Paul Reeve's book, right? Or on Fatima's book, right? So yes, ask them that. But also, yes, question. Why is it, especially if you are in a predominantly Black or brown space, and you're going like, our membership is highly Black and brown. Why is all the bishopric and all the Relief Society presidency white? That is not cool, right? That is not okay. You know, this is, I live in New York City, and I've been to a couple of wards in the Bronx, and there's a lot of white leadership, and those wards are predominantly Black and brown and immigrants. And I don't understand it. I don't understand bringing in a white dude from Utah to lead Black people from the Bronx that are Haitian immigrants and saying, here's, because all that's doing is signaling, here's how you do Mormonism right. Here's how you conform, as opposed to, how do we expand? How do we expand? As opposed to asking you Black and brown people to shrink, how do we expand, right? But yeah, disrupt stuff. So learn as much as you can and continue to do that. I'll end there, I think, because we're at time. But I hope that I was able to give you satisfactory answers to your questions and comments. And again, I appreciate you being here. Enjoy the rest of Sunstone. And I hope I will see you in real life next summer. Bye, everybody.
Awesome. Thanks, Misha. That was so great. Really appreciate it. And I do think, if for those of you that are interested, there is a session on Joanna's book. I think it might be coming up at 3:25. Nope. That it is at 4:50. So if you have some interest in Joanna's book, at 4:50, there's a session. And it is moderated by Mirsa, so you can have some excellent perspectives from two knowledgeable women at that point. So, all right. Well, thank you very much, Misha. Appreciate it. Our time is up. Thank you so much for attending and for supporting Sunstone. And we will see you at another session. Goodbye.